Welcome back. We are the Caught Red Podcast. We are your hosts. I'm Jesse Light.
I'm Megan Light.
We are just two dog lovers talking about true crime, horror movies, and most likely our dogs too. We are recording this Tuesday, January 16th. We finally got our Christmas tree taken down today.
Just been staring at it like, later.
We'll get to it eventually. It was a snow day, so we had to find ways to be productive besides watching. What are we watching?
Goliath,
yes. Billy Bob.
It's good. Season one, so good.
It's very binge worthy.
Oh, yeah. We've already seen it once before.
But I forgot a lot of the craziness.
I didn't remember half that. So we must have been like late night binging it the first time.
Other than that, you know, we didn't even really get that much snow, but just enough to cover up the roads. And, you know, Arkansas with all the crazy drivers, I don't want any part of that. So
we were just saying how it's the first time we've seen people drive slow on Highway 25 in front of our house. Like ever been that slow.
Because we got a big curve and they don't watch out. They'll end up in the ditch.
And the ditch is by a cemetery, which is kind of ironic.
Yeah. Well, Megan's got a doozy for us today. I have no clue what it's about. I don't think you really mentioned much of it to me.
Well, kind
of. She got it ready a week ago, so we're like on top of things now. So,
well, you just jinxed us. So, well, you weren't really feeling that great, so I had to get it done just in case. I went last week, and then you were like, "I'm fine," and then you did yours. So now I've just been just hanging out. I started my next one though yesterday.
Yeah, last week's episode we did about 30 minutes of it, and I was like losing my voice, and then we ended up stopping and retaking the whole thing pretty much. But
it worked out well since you had to go help your dad anyways.
Yeah.
And I was on standby for the restaurant and my car and whatever else. So it's fine.
It's always something.
Everything worked out. It's called life. It happens.
Well, go ahead and take it away.
Alrighty. I've got quite a few sources. There is choosingtherapy.com, BrynDonovan.com, My Life a Crime WordPress, which I just think is like a blog, but I got prisoner information from it. A couple news articles from Ocala, Star Banner, TheAdventist.org, a couple different Find a Graves, Oxygen.com, a few articles from them, TheCrimeWire.com, and then Billings Gazette, AP News, a case file from federal court. I watched season one, episode three of a show called Black Widow Murders from the Oxygen Network, their Oxygen True Crime Network.
What I remember.
What?
I said, that's what I remember you talking about.
Oh.
Or watching the last like 2 minutes of that one with you.
Oh, yeah, you did come in at the end when you got back from helping your dad, I think. And the final source is a book, by Greg Olson called The American Black Widow.
Greg Olson, that's your boy, isn't it?
He's written quite a few that I've enjoyed, yes.
Not to be confused with The Tight End.
I didn't know there was one. There is a saying, once a cheater, always a cheater. But is it true?
If you ain't cheating, you ain't trying.
What? Sometimes you get lucky and it's a one and done kind of situation. It is more than likely something that's going to be repeated. A pattern of infidelity will start to show. There is something about the thrill of it, like sneaking around. It makes it more tantalizing. And the cheater's significant other is none the wiser. The cheater is probably also with someone that he or she can easily manipulate and lie to, especially when the cheater doesn't really see cheating as a mistake. There's no remorse or guilt the majority of the time. Cheating, in my opinion, is one of the most selfish things you could do to somebody that you're in a relationship with, someone you're supposed to be in love with and love to the end of time, you know.
Yeah, how can somebody go around not thinking that it's a bad thing to do?
Right. According to choosingtherapy.com, men are more likely to cheat than women. And if someone cheated in their first relationship, he or she is more than 3 times as likely to cheat again and then continue that cycle. Can you think of anything worse than being cheated on?
Is this for me?
I guess. You think a dog is going to respond?
Ripley, what you think, girl? Oh.
How about being murdered?
That would suck, too.
Yep. Not only will I introduce you to a cheater.
Getting cheated on, then getting murdered would be pretty bad, too.
Yes. So I'm going to introduce you to a cheater, but she's not just that. She's also a Black Widow. You know, that is a subject that is not new for us here on the Caught Red podcast. Episode 29 followed Mary Ellen Samuel, a California woman who was found guilty of arranging the death of her husband and another man who happened to be the hitman. She was dubbed the Green Widow because during her trial, there was a photograph of her showing off all her goodies and barely being covered up by the $20,000 she received following her husband's death. In episode 41, which was turned into a 2-parter, which could have been really a 3-parter, and it was local to us here in Arkansas.
Mary Lee Orsini.
Yes, indeed. Ding, ding, ding. I had never heard of her, but my parents had. Her house was a mile or so from our restaurant's original location, and Mary Lee didn't exactly follow the typical definition of a Black Widow. Because of her, 2 people were killed. One was her husband, and the other one was the wife of the defense attorney that she had hired. Not to mention all the hell she put everyone through with all her lies and deceitfulness. The book I read for the episode is called Widow's Web. It was by Jean Lyons, and it's a very, very appropriate title. And I'm excited for today's episode, and I don't know if that's like wrong or kind of morbid to say, but it was a really fun one. I was entertained throughout. We all know that a Black Widow, besides being a dangerous arachnid, is a woman who is, you know, just as dangerous in a sense that she kills her husband, boyfriend, lover, etc., and she typically has killed multiple. These women are attractive and they have a special kind of charisma, something that allows them to blend in wherever and with whomever they must to get what they want. There's almost always a motive to any murder, whether you pick it up with us here or other podcasts, crime shows, you know, so on and so forth. And a couple of main motives for murder are love and gain. Obviously, there are plenty of other ones, but as far as Black Widows are concerned, those are the top 2. You can also throw jealousy in there if you would like. And those tie into the traits of a cheater. They tend to be more narcissistic and flirtatious by nature. With all that being said, let me tell you about Miss Sharon Lynn Douglas Fuller Nelson Harrelson.
All right. They're all easy to pronounce. There's just a lot of them.
So far, yeah. Sharon was brought into this world on July 3rd, 1945. She was the middle child with an older sister, Judy, and a younger sister, Joy. She and her sisters were raised in a very strict religious home. Her parents raised the girls under the teachings of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And according to their website, their beliefs are meant to permeate your whole life. Growing out of scriptures that paint a compelling portrait of God, you are invited to explore, experience, and know the one who desires to make us whole. They accept the Bible as their only creed. So in other words, Sharon's parents and mainly her mom used religion as a tool to keep their daughters quiet and under control. Of course, this led to one of the Douglas girls to rebel, and it wasn't Sharon, it was the oldest, Judy. She was caught smoking and talking to boys not in the church. She was sent away to a reform school after the police had brought her home late one night from her trying to stay out all night. I know, bad girl. With her gone, Sharon's mother practically banned any talk or mention of Judy. That way, order could be kept in the home, and Sharon and Joy could focus on being good little girls.
So she was just completely disowned, basically.
The oldest sister, yes. More importantly, Sharon's mother wanted to make sure that the Douglas family wasn't looked down in public. Appearances were everything, especially in their little small-knit church community. Behind closed doors at the Douglas house, punishments would be given out for any little thing that was done wrong. If that wasn't enough, Sharon was growing older and coming into her looks, and the men noticed. One member of the church tried to put his hand up her skirt while they were in a car together. The church janitor pushed her into the supply closet and started to feel around on her body. And Sharon never spoke up about these incidents because she was more afraid of the punishments she would receive. Sharon would continue to play by her mother's rules, seeking comfort from her father. Maybe this is where she learned to gain sympathy from the opposite sex. While her mother was cruel and strict, her father showed her affection. Sharon started to figure out the only way to escape and to have some kind of control in her life was to leave, and the only way she could do that, though, was through marriage. At the young age of 18, Sharon Lynn Douglas became Sharon Lynn Fuller. When she met Mike Fuller, he was well on his way to becoming a minister for the Seventh-day Adventist Church. This pleased her parents, as you can imagine. And it really wasn't what she was longing for, but the relationship was approved by all parties, and that was that. Having some freedom, no longer underneath her mother's ruling, was incredible. Sharon had limitations being a minister's wife, after all. She was expected to act and present herself in a certain way. The ministry would end up sending the couple to Ohio, and it wouldn't be long until she would grow bored and tired of being told how to be and what to do. In a different state, in different atmosphere, away from judgmental worries of her hometown congregation, Sharon blossomed. She started to see that men looked at her, and she liked it. She had always felt like she lacked the attention that she craved at home. So sometime after the Fullers got settled in, Sharon went and got a part-time job at a printing company. And while here, she caught the eye of her boss, her older married boss. During the affair, Sharon would end up getting pregnant. In order to keep her marriage and the cheating going, she told her husband that the baby was his. She would give birth to her daughter, which was the first of several children she would have.
And he's like, this don't look like me.
No. They named her Rochelle Fuller, and she was born in 1969. Babies are supposed to bring joy and love into a home, but Sharon wasn't happy. She longed for the type of attention she'd gotten from her boss. It wasn't like anything she'd ever gotten from her own husband. And she was a selfish woman. I'm going to say it now because I assume you will all agree by the end of this. She really wanted out of her marriage, but divorce was not allowed in their religion. There were certain circumstances, and yes, committing adultery was one, but as far as Mike knew, he wasn't being cheated on. He didn't know that his daughter wasn't his own, but it wouldn't be long until he found everything out. During a heated argument, Sharon let it slip. Probably more on purpose to hurt Mike. Determined to make things work, though, the Fuller family decided to move to Durham, North Carolina, for a fresh start. Mike and Sharon even had another daughter, Denise. It would seem as though life was going to be great for the Fullers, but it quickly took a turn for the worse. Sharon had started up yet another affair, this time with someone in the church, and there was no keeping it a secret. Eventually, Mike was given an ultimatum, either get his wife under control or get out of the church, leave his position. When Mike informed Sharon of his decision to move the family, Sharon protested. In her mind, she was being forced to leave behind a man she thought loved her, not thinking what would be best for my family.
That guy was probably married too.
More than likely. Mike said something to her along the lines of, "We're being kicked out because you're a slut."
Pretty much.
Honestly, now Mike and Sharon had grounds for a divorce, but for whatever reason, they stayed together. More likely, Mike trying to keep the family together. In 1976, the Fuller family hit the road and went all the way across the United States to Rocky Ford, Colorado. Almost like an omen, when they arrived to their house, it was not complete. The family spent several nights at a motel where both of the girls became violently ill with a stomach bug. Everyone was exhausted. The Fullers had spent 4 years in North Carolina. They left everything they knew behind. They had no one here to help them out. They'd only received letters from the new church's congregation saying things like, "Oh, we're so excited you're coming to join our church," but they don't know who any of these people are. One evening, Mike returned from work, asking Sharon if she would get herself and the girls ready to go to dinner at one of the elders' houses. She was thrilled for such an outing. Other families were asked to attend, which meant more potential for some adult interaction. Not that kind of interaction now, but kind of, yes.
She probably just wanted to meet other men.
Several members that would be attending had little families, so the girls would hopefully start making some new friends and the adults could chit-chat and become acquainted. The elder hosting dinner that evening was Dr. Perry Nelson and his wife, Julie. Perry was the town's beloved optometrist for nearly 20 years. He is also very handsome. He was head church elder, very prominent, but he was also grateful and humble. He had a family, 3 daughters, Tammy, Kathy, and Lori. Sharon must have thought, this one will do fine. The Nelson family and the other families of the church offered to host dinners to keep the Fullers from having to sit in that motel, or they would offer to watch the girls so Mike and Sharon could go house hunting. They were all pitching in, doing their part, more than just the Nelson family. But if you remember, that was one of the names that I said at the very beginning for her name. Maybe it was because they were new in town, or the people in town had heard the gossip, or just used their own eyes. But the Fullers, mainly Sharon, became the hot topic. She really did bring it upon herself. She didn't dress like a minister's wife, quite the opposite. Her hair was long and bleach blonde. Her dresses were tight. She would purposely unbutton one too many buttons on her blouse. Though, all of that being done, her beauty was natural. She never really caked on a bunch of makeup. She was still young. She was only 31 at this time. As luck would have it, the Fullers ended up finding a new home just houses down from the Nelson residence. And because of this, the Fuller and the Nelson families became very close. They would take trips together. Dr. Perry Nelson had definitely noticed Sharon and took a liking to her. No surprise that she felt the same way towards him. Perry ended up hiring Sharon to do some work around one of his offices located in Trinidad, which is just like an hour's drive from Rocky Ford. And when she came in, Perry's assistant and longtime employee, Barb, was not entirely shocked to see her. Perry had gone on and on about this Sharon for some time, leaving Barb to question his real intentions. She was one of his closest and oldest friends, having worked for him for over a decade at this point, and she knew that Perry wasn't a saint. He had cheated on his wife before. Soon enough, all the signs were there. Barb had noticed right away that there was something different about Perry. His wife, Julie, also was suspecting something was going on with him. And thus began the whirlwind love affair between Perry Nelson and Sharon Fuller. If they wanted to keep it a secret, they sucked at it. It didn't take long for the community of Rocky Ford to know that they were having an affair. To help or worsen the situation, Perry and Sharon decided that they wanted to be together and they were going to leave their spouses. Mike had really hoped that things in Colorado would have been better, that he and Sharon would rekindle their romance, even though it was always just one-sided. Sharon never really felt loved by Mike. She had even overheard him say once that he didn't really love her. He actually learned of the affair from another couple in their church when they saw Sharon and Perry at a motel together. Julie's gut feeling was confirmed when Perry didn't come home from work one evening and she had called the office and Barb was like, he left with Sharon. And that same evening, the one when she called the office, when she got home from running errands, she found Mike Fuller on her porch steps. He ended up telling Julie about his and Sharon's past, her having several affairs, that Rochelle wasn't even his biological child, even though he did love her like she was. All the strain from the affair and the secrecy wore down on Sharon. She phoned a friend in Fort Worth, Texas, and took her friend's advice to drive down there to get away from everyone and get her head on straight. She was racked with guilt and uncertainty, but mainly of herself. So she packs a bag and she left Colorado, leaving behind Perry, Mike, and her girls. For 2 weeks, almost every day, Sharon saw a psychologist who convinced her that her marriage was worth saving. They concluded that she needed to stay away from Perry and focus on what was really important, which should be her family. Mike even flew in so they could do couples counseling together for a few days, and then the two of them drove back together. Mike had already moved to a new church in the Arvada area of Denver. Sharon was not going to see Perry Nelson anymore. She's going to be a good wife to Mike. She's going to be a great mother to the girls. To stay busy, she got a job at a hospital in Denver. She stayed true to her word. But on the flip side, she was drinking a lot to cope. And if that's not a cry for help and to show how unhappy she was, I don't know what is. Sharon one day just up and decided that she was going to quit her job. And she told Mike she was moving out. She was going to get her own place. She told Mike that he could have everything minus the couch and her sewing machine. She never mentioned the girls, by the way. She went to go visit her big sister, Judy, who had moved to Colorado Springs. And guess who drove up to meet her?
Perry.
That's right. Dr. Perry Nelson. And Mike was no fool. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, or like five times, shame on me. He figured what Sharon was probably up to. And he went and got a court order to take the girls from Sharon. He had plenty of support from his friends and the congregation.
She didn't want them anyways.
No, not right then. Mike and a friend drove to serve the papers to Sharon, and she said, you can have them. She didn't even fight for her daughters. Perry told his wife that he and Sharon were meant to be, and they were going to be together. Julie Nelson, disgusted with her soon-to-be ex-husband, said good riddance and packed her and Lori, the youngest daughter, and moved out. She was the only daughter living in their house at the time. She was 13. By the time 1977 rolled around, Sharon and Perry had divorced their spouses. Sharon had moved all the way into the Nelson residence. In July of that year, they got married and moved into a new house for a fresh start. It was just the two of them, which is what Sharon wanted from the beginning. Julie and Lori Nelson were in California. Mike had full custody of Rochelle and Denise, and they moved back to Ohio. Sharon returned to her role of office manager in the Trinidad office, but no surprise, she was not very good at it. I doubt she even tried. When the money came in, especially cash, she took it. In her eyes, this is also her business, and she had every right to every dollar, even if it meant she didn't pay bills.
Well, he hired her in the beginning because he had the hots for her, not because she was good at the job.
Exactly. Becoming a doctor's wife had been a dream, and she was loving it. living every moment up. Barb, yes, she's still holding strong at the office despite her hatred of Sharon. Barb had no idea bills were not being taken care of until she tried to make monthly orders. When Barb went to Perry and told him what she discovered, she's putting blame on Sharon. It like went in one ear, out the other. In his eyes, Sharon could do no wrong. Not only was she stealing from the office, but she was terrible with clients to the point that they didn't want to be seen by their beloved family eye doctor.
He'd probably built up a lot of clients over the years, too. All in his church and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And then she's just like scaring them all off now.
Running them off, yes. In March of 1978, Sharon gave birth to the couple's first child, a son, Danny. In 1980, they welcomed a daughter, Misty. Thrilled to have a family with Sharon and start this new chapter together, Perry agreed to build Sharon her dream house. A very luxurious house that would overlook the town. It was isolated up towards the mountain. Sharon called it the Roundhouse because all fancy places had a nickname. I have no idea where it came from. I never found why she called it Roundhouse, but because it was going to be this banger of a home, it needed a name. An older member of the church had once said to her husband, "Poor Julie, she waited 5 years to remodel her kitchen, and Sharon just got whatever she wanted when she wanted." Perry Nelson was head over heels, infatuated with Sharon, but who knows how much of that reciprocated. Sharon had made the suggestion that she sought out Perry. When Mike took over the church, it gave her access to all the members' records, and she saw early on that Perry was successful and wealthy.
I feel like it's only a matter of time before she cheats on him, too.
Well, hold on. We'll get to that. Sharon and Perry's blissful romance was starting to crack. She had practically dried out his accounts, spending and living life as she saw fit. She had run off nearly all of his clients, and Perry couldn't pay the bills. She saw nothing wrong what was going on, as if she wasn't bothered by Perry's stress level. Sharon grew bored not long after the birth of Misty, their second child. She found renewed excitement with a gentleman named Buzz Reynolds. I love it. This man was someone who Perry considered to be a friend, but I guess Buzz didn't care about breaking the bro code or anything. And yes, Buzz was a wealthy, self-made man. He was a rancher in Colorado. Sharon was wanting a divorce from Perry and was quite petty about the whole thing. The Nelsons were often heard arguing over everything. Perry was at the point where he was showing up drunk to work. He was miserable. Everything he'd worked for was dwindling. The woman he thought he loved was shacking up with one of his best friends. He was contemplating ending it all, but thank God for Barb. She really was his only friend and support system. She was just helping him get through it little by little. Just when Perry was starting to get back on his feet, here comes Sharon. Buzz and her had this great thing going until she got pregnant in 1982. Buzz wanted nothing to do with a child or her after that, so Sharon had no choice but go crawling back to Perry. Perry stood his ground and refused her, telling her he wouldn't raise another man's child. I don't know what made her come to this conclusion, but this was her solution to the whole thing. Since neither man in her life wanted that baby, she had an abortion. By March of 1982, for reasons still unknown, Sharon was welcomed back into the Nelson home, aka the Roundhouse. It was like Perry had forgotten the last few months, years even, all of her wrongdoings. They were going to work things out, and they called off their divorce. This was a shock and a punch in the faces of everyone who cared for Perry. No one in Perry's life or really anyone in general, liked Sharon, especially Barb. Barb had been working for Perry for close to 2 decades by this point, but with all the financial issues the clinic was having, Perry could only afford one employee, and he stupidly chose his wife, letting the most loyal person in his life go. And if that wasn't enough of a stab in the heart, when Barb went to go file for unemployment, she was denied because that was one of those bills that Sharon never put money into, was the unemployment fund.
Oh my gosh.
But don't worry. Sharon was still a vicious cycle herself. While she's back at the Nelson home, she would soon catch the eye of Gary Starr Adams. She made sure he noticed her. Gary was a jack-of-all-trades handyman. He was doing work not far from her house when she just happened to be outside with her hair pulled up and her boobies all out. They chatted for a few minutes, becoming acquainted, learning that they were kind of like neighbors. Gary, his wife Nancy, and their daughter lived down the hill from the Nelson home. Nothing happened between the two, but there was this strange attraction slowly building. Wanting to see Gary again, Sharon proposed that they throw a Halloween party for the neighborhood. She took the opportunity to drag Gary onto the dance floor and invite him to the clinic later that week so they get to know each other better. Perry wasn't going to be in the office on Thursday. She was going to be there doing nitpick work, meeting clients for little things here and there. Gary was intrigued and decided, why not? He showed up at the office, and just as he and Sharon were getting ready to get to know each other, air quotes there, a client came in to pick up some glasses.
My glasses.
He got cock-blocked. Sharon returned to Gary and suggested that he go get a motel room and she would meet up with him soon. As if he was already under her spell, Gary did just that. Sharon joined him and he was blown away by her playboy-worthy body. Not my words. Those are his. Those are not my words.
Oh my God.
Things got hot and heavy between the two, but then there was a snag. Gary was having some performance issues. He had said that it was never an issue before, but maybe he should have listened to his wiener. Like, it was telling him, don't do this, don't get involved. But too bad he didn't listen to that or his gut. There was something about Gary Adams that appealed to Sharon. He wasn't her normal target. He wasn't rich. And technically, they weren't sleeping together at this point. So we know it wasn't the sex. It was just him as a person. She was attracted to him. His personality, the attention that he gave her, which I will point out is exactly what she used to say about Perry while she was still married to Mike Fuller, her first husband. Finally, after months of sneaking around, Gary was no longer having those performance issues, and the two completed that last step in the How to Create an Affair handbook. Following that day, Gary and Sharon were constantly with each other, drawn together to do one thing, have sex. Sharon felt more connected to Gary than any of the men she'd ever been with. She may have actually loved him. She wanted to be free and clear of everything that tied her to Perry. Perry was holding her back from truly being happy, and you know what would make her even happier? If she was without Perry and with Gary and rich.
How's that going to happen?
So she comes up with a plan.
She's going to kill Perry, take all his money, get with Gary, then cheat on Gary with some other guy named Jerry. And then the whole cycle continues. She's going to cheat on Jerry with Larry.
Listen, you're really not too far off, but hold on, okay? One night in June of 1983, Gary and a buddy of his just happened to run into Perry as they were driving up to Denver. Perry was on his way from a conference. The men on this so-called whim decided to pull off at a bar for a few beers. When Perry got up to break his seal, Gary slipped something into his drink, hoping to knock Perry out. And that was the first part of the plan. Knock him out, then take care of him. The only problem was that Perry wasn't going down. It was quite obvious that he'd become an alcoholic. So the men just rode out the night, drinking, then they crashed in a motel room, and then they got breakfast in the morning. Perry never suspected a thing. And then Gary knew Sharon was going to be furious. And not only that, Sharon was shocked to see her husband walk through the door the next day. Like, she's like, oh, he shouldn't even be dead.
Oh.
Gary and Sharon plotted Perry's murder once again.
Were they going to kill Gary's wife too, or what?
No. No. Gary wasn't going to allow that.
Okay.
This is all Sharon, obviously.
It's crazy how she gets all these married men to go after her and just leave their whole lives behind. Like, she's not getting these single guys to drop everything and get with her.
No, it's like she looks for them to be married.
It's like she wants to split people up. She's a homewrecker.
She likes seeing that commitment.
Yeah.
After a few weeks, the opportunity presented itself. The men had actually started to become friends, which makes it even more unfortunate. Gary knew that Perry was going to be heading back up to Denver, and this would be on July 22nd. He asked if he could hitch a ride. Gary said he was going to go buy a couple guns off a buddy, and Perry loved the idea of having one for hunting. Gary told Perry that there'd be plenty if he wanted one too. The men were on their way. They chatted about life, marriage, family, all that. As Gary is riding shotgun and listening to Perry, he's almost starting to question himself if this was going to be worth it. Is Sharon really worth it? He liked the guy. Plus, he was starting to find it hard that Perry would ever lay a hand on Sharon. She'd shown Gary some bruises and told Gary that Perry was abusive, and Gary's not seeing it. He didn't see how he could be that way.
So they got a bromance going on now.
They did.
And he didn't want to follow through with it.
They did. The very next morning, during the early hours of July 23rd, 1983, Gary had snuck back home. After a couple hours passed, he and his wife walk up to the roundhouse. Gary told his wife, Nancy, that Perry owed him some money and was told to come get it in the morning. As Sharon opened the door, Gary said Perry was supposed to leave him money. She runs off, grabs a $100 bill to hand to him, and asked him if everything was okay. Gary quietly responded, yes, Perry's not coming back. See, while the men were driving, Gary asked if they could pull over so he could pee.
They took him to the train station?
No.
No.
They were close to Clear Creek. Perry had parked in the lot next to it and was just going to catch a couple hours of sleep. Gary decided to hop out to pee. And when he returned to the car, he pretended to be frantic, stating that he lost his wallet. Perry, being a good guy, agreed to help him look, and as he searched the ground, Gary picked up a rock and struck Perry in the head. To Gary's surprise, Perry got back up. The men fought, and Gary tried to hold Perry under the water in the creek, but again, Perry got back up. By this point, neither man noticed how deep they'd gotten into the creek, and almost in an instant, Perry was forcibly swept away by current. It had been pouring the whole day, and there were flash flood warnings. Gary watched as Mother Nature took Perry, astonished, really, that it could have easily been him instead or with Perry. He climbed out of the creek, he got into Perry's car, and he pushed it into the creek. He stood and watched as the car followed behind Perry's body. Then Gary walked up until he reached a spot to meet another friend of his just outside of Denver in Golden, Colorado. Earlier in the evening, Gary and Perry had stopped off for food and beer. While at this bar, Gary had called a buddy of his and asked him to pick him up near that parking lot. So it's heartbreaking to think that Gary had all this planned out while Perry had no clue, probably really enjoying this new bromance and his new friend on their way to Denver. If it wasn't for an unexpected visit from old friends of Perry's swinging by the house, I doubt Sharon would have done anything in regard to Perry being missing. Because of them, Sharon had to play the scared wife. It had nearly been a day since Perry was due to return home. Sharon called to see if there were any reports that had come in involving any accidents with his car. He had a black VW Bug. There was nothing. Then a couple of joggers were out near Clear Creek and they spotted a car in the water and they had discovered Perry Nelson's vehicle, but Perry was nowhere to be seen. Everyone was hoping that Perry was still alive. Well, maybe not everyone. And the search for the missing man began. When word got back to Barb, she just knew it was Sharon's doing that she'd killed him. Sharon seemed to be a bit calm despite everything going on around her. She was already making plans to sell Perry's businesses and his guns, anything that would make her a pretty penny. The man was still missing, and it wasn't even days before she was doing what she always did. Even before all of this, the rumor mill was on fire. There was gossip around town that Sharon and Gary were hooking up. Then 2 months go by after Perry's gone missing, and Gary has pretty much moved in with Sharon. It was a shit show. The two could obviously sleep together, but living together was a big no-no. Gary went back to living with his wife, still seeing Sharon, though. And Sharon's furious about the whole situation and thought the best thing to do was make Gary jealous, so she went back and hooked up with Buzz Reynolds. Naturally, Gary was weak. He ended up telling his wife that it was best that they separate. She happily agreed. She was tired of playing games. She and their daughter moved to Denver, and when she filed for divorce and had papers sent to Gary, she was not the least bit shocked that he had moved back in with Sharon.
That is so wild.
I don't know what it is about this woman, like a golden vagina or something. Fast forward 13 or so months. It's now August 14th, 1984. Sharon, Gary, and the Nelson children were out for a nice summer drive when they get pulled over. The deputy had been on his way to the roundhouse to inform Sharon that they believe they found Perry's body. It had washed ashore near Golden, which is not far from where the car was found, but here's the weird thing about it. One of Perry's closest friends was a doctor. Upon hearing the news, he asked if he could view the body. The news had stated that the body appeared to be a male in his 30s, but Perry was 50. When Sharon had described Perry's outfit the day he had gone missing, it matched what this man was wearing. Perry's doctor friend was denied his request to view the body because Sharon had already sent it to be cremated. Apparently, Sharon had not received the entire insurance payout because there was no body for the official death certificate. Perry's friend also doubted that the body had been there for a year. There was no way it hadn't already been discovered, but he wasn't able to see it in person to know what to believe. He could do nothing about it, but he suspected that this was all some big plan to get rich, and Sharon was behind it all. She had just been awarded $250,000, and yeah, she blew it all. Because Sharon is a creature of habit, even though she was almost 40 by this point, she still continued to be with Gary, but also Buzz, and also this new guy, Harry. I'm telling you, I don't understand these men. I don't see the appeal, but there's something about her. In an unexpected turn of events, Gary left Sharon and crawled his way back to Nancy, his wife, ex-wife, whatever. In the spring of 1987, Sharon was sad and heartbroken. She missed Gary and needed to feel something. So she took to the personal ads of the paper. She was currently living in a cute little rent house in Denver, taking a break from the life that she had known for so many years. Her kids were off with their grandparents, so she had a chance to do whatever she wanted. But let's be honest, she always did. One of the ads piqued her interest. Glenn Harrelson. Glenn was a Vietnam veteran like many during that time, and he was also a firefighter. He had previously been married for 22 years when he and his wife just knew it was time. Things were not going to go well if they kept being married. As she made herself a drink and lit a cigarette, Sharon decided to call the number in the ad, and she asked the very unsuspecting Glenn if he wanted to grab a couple of six-packs and come over.
They didn't have Tinder back then, so...
Yeah, that was the closest thing. Glenn was like all the men before, just infatuated with Sharon. His buddies saw him less and less. One of Glenn's friends described Sharon as a homecoming queen gone bad. It wasn't long until he asked her and her kids to move in with him. He was the happiest he'd been in years, but like everything else around her, it wouldn't last long. For example, when Glenn was very ill and had to go to the hospital, Glenn's ex-wife was surprised when he called her to take him. Where was this new live-in girlfriend? Apparently, she was out with a friend. All of Glenn's friends could see how controlling Sharon was, changing him little by little, and they were growing concerned. Then, one day, Sharon was just gone. Glenn was shocked to know Sharon had been seeing someone else practically the whole time they were together. Glenn was determined to win her back. He wanted to marry her. He said Sharon made him feel alive. Remember that. And before everyone knew it, Sharon was back and he was going to propose. Shortly before he made this decision, Glenn had gone to his insurance guy to name Sharon his beneficiary.
They need to do some background checks or something. Shit. God.
On June 2nd, 1988, they said I do in front of a judge. Things were strange, to say the least. A weird marriage with a weirder arrangement. She didn't want to move in with Glenn. Glenn couldn't move because of work. They split the time between two homes. Glenn was in Thornton. Sharon was back home at the house that Perry had built for her, Roundhouse. Glenn would come out for the weekends to visit, making an almost 8-hour drive, 4 there and 4 back. Her excuse was that the kids did better in a smaller school system, but really, it was to be closer to the man that she never got over because she never forgot about Gary Star Adams. Gary knew she was trouble, her being up the hill once again, but it wasn't long until that relationship had sparks. She had even told Gary that she got married, but she missed him. She really was wild and all over the place.
Wonder how Nancy feels now. Like
Nancy's probably like, this bitch.
Yeah.
Sharon had married a minister, a doctor, now a firefighter, but all she wanted was the handyman down the street. The heart wants what the heart wants, I guess. It was time to come up with another plan, one that would allow her to be with Gary and no longer with Glenn. Glenn and Sharon hadn't even been married for 3 months, and she's planning his murder. Like Perry, she wanted Gary to do it for her. and to bring back Glenn's wedding ring as proof. Glenn either kept his ring on the dresser or was in the front pocket of his jeans. Gary thought the best plan of action would be to kill Glenn at home, put him in his car, and then make it look like a car accident. That very method is what he had intended to do with Perry, but things got out of hand. Glenn wasn't stupid, not entirely. He knew that Sharon was having an affair, and likely with Gary. He had figured it out one weekend when he saw some cigarettes, and they weren't the brand that Sharon smoked, but the kind Gary did, so obviously he'd met Gary at some point. He felt in his gut. He had rushed things. He was so over it, over her. He told a couple friends that he had, yes, regretted marrying Sharon. Of course, like she does, she played the part of the doting wife in love. He said, she said, he regrets marriage, she bangs other guys, tomato, tomato, you know. By 6:30 a.m. on Sunday, November 20th, 1988, Glenn Harrelson failed to show up for his shift. The fire chief knew that he was staying with Sharon fairly often, driving hours south on the weekend, but maybe he was running late or he was sick. But if he was one of those things, he would have called in. Something didn't feel right. Then a call comes in. There was a house fire at 12370 Columbine Court. Since it was suspected to be arson due to noticeable pour patterns, police detective and investigators were on the scene. As far as anyone knew, the owner wasn't home. It wasn't until a fellow firefighter said loud enough, "Where's Glenn?" that Detective Bob Lloyd even knew that he was at the home of one of their own. Both vehicles were there, but no one could find Glenn. Fingers crossed that he wasn't home and really was out of town with Sharon. As the detective walked through Glenn's house, nothing indicated that he'd been home. All his gear was put away. The bed was made. Nothing seemed to point to robbery either. The house didn't look ransacked. Oddly enough, in the basement, there was a chair pushed under a window and the window's grate was missing. But there were spider webs that were not disturbed. So it seemed like someone wanted to look like that's how he or she got in. But then those webs untouched meant that the intruder didn't go that way or use that way. Detective Lloyd suspected someone came in through the front door either by invitation or with a key. But again, if it was by invitation, where was Glenn? As he went into the garage where most of the fire had been, he saw a crawl space, a very deep one. Detective Lloyd requested more lighting, and as soon as his eyes adjusted, he saw what he didn't want to find, a figure. A man. He yelled out, "We have a homicide." It was the charred remains of 44-year-old Glenn Harrelson. Later that day, two shell casings were found in Glenn's house. Someone had purposely gone into the home, shot Glenn, and staged the house fire to get rid of the evidence. It didn't take long for the investigators to learn about Sharon, the apple of Glenn's eye. All the men who worked with or knew Glenn had heard about the sketchy courtship. Many, if not all of them, did not approve of Glenn's bride. Detective Lloyd stayed behind at the scene while two of his colleagues, Elaine Tigert and Glenn Traynor, were sent to make the death notification. Once they arrived to the Rocky Ford area, the detectives were informed how remote Roundhouse was and that they would need a guide. The local deputy filled them in on Sharon's previous husband's mysterious death. Sharon had always been the talk of the town. As he put it, if you wore pants and were looking for a good time, Sharon was your kind of lady. At the Roundhouse was Sharon, Rochelle, her first daughter, and the two kids that she had had with Perry. Sharon's reaction to the news was extreme and a bit over the top. Not saying that you can't act the way that she did, but she and Glenn had only been together for a short time, married even less than that. But they all knew the kind of revolving door that she was, so they didn't really believe it. The detective asked if she would come in for questioning, and she obliged. She made sure that she was dressed to the nines, her hair and makeup were done. Sharon told the story of her life throughout all the years, but she left out one very important detail. Gary. They already knew the man, the myth, the legend. Instead of mentioning him, even though the police were already telling her, "You know who did this to Glenn," she broke down into tears and started to play the victim. She kept saying that she wasn't safe. They couldn't talk there. The detectives must have rolled their eyes, but they loaded her and her kids up, and Sharon suggested they go to this Pizza Hut in Walsenburg, which is very unusual of a request, but off they went. This Pizza Hut held many great memories for Sharon, and it felt like the right place for her to come clean. She started over, telling about how it all started when she and Perry had money problems. It put a strain on the marriage, and that was when she sought out the attention from Gary. She went on to tell that over time, she and Gary fell in love, and they wanted to be together, but Perry stood in their way. Gary told Sharon that he would take care of him. She told the detectives that she didn't know all the details, but she knew that Gary had done it. She said that Gary told her that two things covered tracks well: water and fire. Sharon had told them that she and Gary were on and off, but he could never really just let her go. He'd gotten hurt and mad when she married Glenn. Gary was jealous, and she didn't want Sharon and Glenn to be together. Sharon even told the police where to find Glenn's ring at her house. Gary's confession was in the mailbox. She informed them that Gary had several guns, but wasn't sure where he kept them, so they had to be careful. The detectives almost felt the love that Sharon had for Gary, even though she's over here throwing him under the bus. It was like the way that she spoke about him felt very sincere. The ring and the confession were right where she said they would be. All they needed now was the evidence of Gary's entry. They suspected that he used Sharon's key to the house and then put it right back on her key ring. They had already placed Sharon under arrest for her involvement in the death of Perry, and it wouldn't be long until they added Glenn's murder too. Monday, November 21st, 1988, Gary Starr Adams was arrested for first-degree murder. Two nights prior, on Saturday, November 19th, Sharon gave Gary her key to Glenn's house. He had brought with him a .22 caliber pistol, but only if the pipe in his hands didn't do the trick. He had Sharon draw him the layout of the house and where he would find the bedroom so he could get the wedding band. Gary went in and he sat in Glenn's recliner and he waited. It was 8:45 p.m. As he played out different scenarios in his head, Gary almost talked himself out of it. Not again, not another one. But as he stood to leave, he saw headlights and he remembered how much he loved Sharon. As soon as he saw the man enter the house, the man being Glenn, he knew the pipe wasn't going to work. He would have to shoot him to take him down. Gary fired twice and it was done. Sharon told Gary about the removable grates on the basement windows and where he could find Glenn's supply of gasoline. Gary created himself a timer. He put a lit cigarette in a book of matches and left the same way he went in through the front door. It was about 4 a.m. when he made it back to Sharon's house. He showed her the ring and they went to bed. No one knew that solving Glenn's death was actually going to solve another strange death, Perry Nelson's. in the end, in 1989, both Sharon and Gary pled guilty in order to avoid the death penalty and have an option of parole. There would be no trial, even though I'm sure Sharon would have loved to have been in that spotlight. She said she didn't want to go to trial for the sake of her children, but I don't really know how truthful that is. I don't know if she really even loved him. It really didn't feel like that for a few years, you know. She was convicted on 2 counts of first-degree murder. It took some time for Gary to own up. Initially, he was going to go with a plea of not guilty, but then he came to his senses. Probably because he found out that Sharon, the woman that wreaked hell on his life and his heart, would have been testifying against him.
The detectives probably told him, like, look, she threw you under the bus.
Yeah, exactly. He ultimately sealed his fate while in jail, though. He was blabbing to a cellmate and shared the location of the gun he used to kill Glenn. And that cellmate went off and snitched on him.
He wanted some reduced sentencing himself.
Sharon and Gary could have potentially been caught years before Glenn's murder. The company that handled Perry Nelson's life insurance claims noted the suspicious circumstances around Perry's death. The company didn't tell the police about Perry not being alone the evening he went missing, or that Sharon bought 5 policies 6 weeks before he went missing. In 1996, Lori, who was Perry Nelson's youngest daughter from his first marriage, and the only child to really be around during those Sharon years, filed a lawsuit against the insurance company because they did indeed have enough evidence to make Sharon a murder suspect in Perry's death. And for that reason, the company should have never awarded her anything. Her and her siblings, Lori and her siblings, received the full amount plus interest. So way more than $250,000. Sharon passed away while behind bars in 2017. She was 72. Gary is at the Lyman Correctional Facility in Lyman, Colorado. He has a shot at parole in April of 2030. If so, he would be 87 when he gets out, if he's let out. Mike Fuller dodged a bullet and or a rock.
Is that the first guy?
The first husband, by divorcing Sharon so early on. He was the only man who really saw who she was, probably because he knew her before she changed her parents, before she became that desperate housewife. Call it intuition or God's plan.
He still gave her a million chances that she didn't deserve.
It's really sad that 2 men had to die. Perry Nelson and Gary Harrelson may have left their families behind for Sharon, but it didn't make their ex-wives less important, their kids from those marriages less important. There was this one quote in the book that stuck with me, and it's about 3/4 of the way through. It's after Perry Nelson went missing. And you know that kids can be a little creepy, right? Sharon was behind on payments for the house, taxes, everything. And a couple of real estate agents had gone up to the roundhouse, and Danny, Sharon and Perry's 6-year-old son, answered the door. One of the agents asked if his mommy was home, and the little boy replied, "Mom's in the house, Dad's in the river."
That is creepy.
And that is the story of Sharon Lynn Douglas Fuller Nelson Harrelson, the Black Widow for this week.
Wow.
I told you it was a doozy of one.
She is evil.
She was all over the place.
Deceitful, manipulative. Oof. That tops Mary Lee Orsini and what's the other, Mary Samuels?
Uh-huh.
Gosh.
Once a cheater, always a cheater.
Black Widow on steroids.
Literally.
Well, good job, love.
Thank you. That I said, I don't know if it was morbid to say, but it was a fun one to do.
I bet.
Every time.
I need to turn that into a book. Or I guess you did read a book about it. Yeah, never mind.
Into a movie?
Yeah.
That's a Lifetime movie right there. There might be a Lifetime movie based off it, but just like name something else.
A little mini series.
Every time I came across a different article or was reading that book, I was like, how? I don't understand this woman.
She kind of reminded me of, what's that show with Jessica Biel where she...
Candy.
She kind of reminded me of Candy a little bit there.
I can see that.
Yeah. Except she didn't take an axe to the other woman. But
and Jessica Biel's way more attractive than Sharon.
Was she? Not according to Gary and Glenn and Harry and Buzz and
Perry and
Larry
Mike,
and
yep.
all them. She was God's greatest gift to Earth, apparently.
To wieners. Married wieners.
Well, that wraps up today's episode. Thank y'all for listening. Next week, we'll be back. I've got an episode for y'all, so stay tuned. But until then... stay local, shop local,
murder local.